When we talk about what we're going to be doing to reduce our emissions, we also need to be stressing our energy independence in this nation.
Taking a look at Senator Lisa Murkowski's history with climate change. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the military is working to adapt to new Arctic conditions.
We want to understand and get after what capabilities and requirements are needed in this changing environment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
After filing for bankruptcy protection last summer, Penn Air has been ordered to sell off its assets to avoid a shutdown. A federal judge has scheduled the auction for early October, following an emergency motion by the trustee appointed to oversee the airline's bankruptcy proceedings. In the motion filed last week, trustee Gerald McHale argued for the expedited sale schedule in light of Penn Air's quickly deteriorating cash position. Court documents indicate the company owes at least $10 million to more than 200 creditors, including the state of Alaska, the city of Unalaska, and Alaska Airlines. Penn Air is one of Southwest Alaska's largest air carriers, and the only one connecting Unalaska and most Aleutian and Pribilof communities to Anchorage. McHale says he's confident Penn Air has enough financial backing to remain afloat through November, and that he already has bidders lined up. He's also assured Vice Mayor Dennis Robinson that Unalaska's flights will continue normally during the sale, but he says that remains to be seen for the carrier's seven other routes, which include Dillingham, Cold Bay, and St. Paul Island. An Alaska seafood organization is encouraging industry members to comment on the proposed U.S. tariffs on products imported from China that could negatively affect the state's seafood industry. The Associated Press reports that Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is asking members to comment before the September deadline on the proposed tariff increases on seafood products from China. According to the organization that promotes the state's seafood industry, about $2.7 billion in U.S. seafood is processed in China and sent back to the U.S. annually, with most of that coming from Alaska. In response to U.S. tariffs, China levied its own tariffs last month that included imported seafood. It excluded seafood intended for re-export after processing. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative proposed increasing tariffs from 10% to 25%. Lisa Murkowski is one of the few Republicans in Congress now who goes out of her way to talk about climate change and says we need to reduce emissions. As with abortion and health care, on climate, the Republican senator stands to the left of her party. But climate advocates say her deeds don't match her words. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you the second season of its podcast, Midnight Oil. Last season, we looked back at the state's 50-year history with oil. This season, we're looking ahead to one of the biggest challenges facing the state now. That's climate change. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin looked back at Murkowski's history on climate change.
The issue wasn't always so partisan. There's this goofy ad from 2008. Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich are sitting outside on a love seat in front of the Capitol.
We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?
No, but we do agree our country must take action to address climate change.
It wasn't just Gingrich. Back in the mid-2000s, Republican senators like Richard Lugar and Lindsey Graham called for climate action. John McCain made it part of his 2008 campaign for the White House.
John McCain stood up to the president and sounded the alarm on global warming.
In 2009, it seemed like a bill to limit greenhouse gas emissions had a real chance. That summer, the Democratic-controlled House passed a cap-and-trade bill. That's where the government would put a limit on greenhouse gas emissions and let industries buy and sell the rights to send CO2 into the atmosphere, with the idea that if it costs money to emit, companies would cut back. A bipartisan group in the Senate was working on a compromise version, and Murkowski must have seemed like a natural to join their efforts. For years, she'd called climate change a problem. She acknowledged Alaskans were already seeing the effects, and she called reducing carbon emissions the right thing to do. But she wasn't on board. 2 years prior, she had sponsored a bill that included limited cap and trade, but now she had a different emphasis.
When we talk about what we're going to be doing to reduce our emissions, we also need to be stressing our energy independence in this nation.
And the key to energy independence, she said, is increasing domestic oil and gas production, along with renewables and nuclear power. A reporter tried to pin her down in a 2009 C-SPAN interview. What if a bill expanded nuclear power, offshore drilling, and renewables, and capped carbon emissions?
Would you vote for it?
It depends how the cap and trade piece is structured, because I have...
She wouldn't be pinned down. Murkowski does passionately support money for energy innovation. But what she has always resisted is a tax on fossil fuels, or any regulation of carbon that she says would damage the American economy.
We're not just going to be able to shut the whole thing down and say, well, this is what we have to do in order to save the planet.
In other words, her climate solutions are all carrot, no stick. And really, who likes sticks? Murkowski says raising the cost of energy would hit especially hard in Alaska, where fuel and power prices are already in the stratosphere. In the end, the 2009 cap-and-trade bill fizzled in the Senate. And in the decade since, no carbon regulation bill has gotten anywhere near the finish line. And Murkowski hasn't pressed for one. In fact, when Obama's EPA moved to regulate carbon, she led a charge to defeat it.
It's pretty clearly, for a decade now, just been talk.
Joe Rome writes a climate blog. He's a former Deputy Secretary of Energy from the Clinton administration. He says Murkowski's carrots-only approach is not a solution because it's too slow to prevent catastrophic warming.
And every time she's had a chance to actually take some serious action to deal with climate change, she has either done nothing or been an outright opponent.
Rome says Murkowski seems to be following an old Republican playbook.
The way to sound like you care about the climate but don't have to do anything is to say that the solution is innovation and not regulations. And the problem is climate change is an existential threat.
He says if limiting or taxing greenhouse gases would hurt the economy, letting the planet warm out of control is even more expensive, with all the wildfires, storms, and real estate lost to the sea. In other words, Rome says climate change is an issue where extreme moderation won't do. What we need, he says, is real action. And to him, that means limiting greenhouse gas emissions. I talked to Senator Murkowski often, but couldn't get her to sit down for an interview on climate change. I'm not really sure why. But I did have a colleague find her at an oil and gas conference in Anchorage and ask her whether she might support cap and trade again, or any policy that seeks to put a price on carbon. Murkowski says a national policy raising the cost of energy would be bad for people in Alaska villages, like the struggling mom she met who already pays a fortune for heating oil.
I can't go back to her and say, for purposes of a national policy, I'm sorry, we're going to have to increase what you are paying.
She didn't exactly say no, but bottom line, Murkowski isn't pushing to regulate or tax CO2. So if that's how you define taking action on climate, no, she does not support it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
That story is part of the podcast Midnight Oil, The Big Thaw from Alaska's Energy Desk. To hear more, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, descendants of Attu want permanent access to their ancestral home.
I want my children's children to be able to go back to Attu with no cost to us. And that's the justice that needs to be done on our people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
A multi-state salmonella outbreak that impacted Alaska has been linked to an alternative medicine. An investigation by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration found that the drug kratom caused nearly 200 cases of salmonella in 41 states, including two Alaska cases. The outbreak occurred between last winter and this spring. Kratom is a tropical tree native to Southeast Asia and a cousin of the coffee tree. It's both a stimulant and a sedative, and people use it to treat everything from opioid withdrawal to chronic pain. The FDA hasn't approved the drug and cautions against using it. It's currently legal in Alaska and all but six states. The two Alaskans first reported symptoms this spring. One bought the kratom online, the other bought it in powder form from an unmarked bin at a store in Anchorage. Neither was subject to oversight from an Alaska regulatory entity because the packaging didn't claim that it was edible or therapeutic. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration and FDA are currently considering placing the drug on the federal controlled substance list. Reported problems include addiction, seizures, and psychosis. 50 people were hospitalized, but no one died in the outbreak. Three residents of an Alaska village died in a riverboat accident. Alaska state troopers say the bodies of three residents of Tuntutuliak were pulled Sunday from the Kuskokwim River. Tuntutuliak is 40 miles from the Bering Sea coast and 440 miles west of Anchorage. Troopers identified the dead as 50-year-old Peter Joseph Jr., 43-year-old Jennifer Joseph, and 44-year-old Nettie Evan. A family member on Saturday afternoon spoke by phone to Jennifer Joseph, who reported that the Josephs and Evan were on the Kuskokwim River between Napaskiak and Napakiak and headed home. The Josephs' unoccupied boat at about 6 p.m. Saturday was spotted on a sandbar. Tides lifted the boat from the sandbar, and it was found Monday at Eek Island. The U.S. military is looking for new ways to expand its presence in Arctic waters. Last week, Alaskan Command, based at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, hosted its first-ever Arctic Maritime Symposium. The three-day event brought together senior military officials, academics, and civilian leaders to discuss what shifting geopolitics and a changing environment could mean for the nation's military presence in Alaska. General Terence O'Shaughnessy commands NORAD and defense assets throughout North America. He says one of the main reasons the U.S. needs a better understanding of the Arctic is Russia's expanding presence in the region and interest in the Northern Sea Route.
Now we must keep in mind that for the Russians, the Arctic is their front yard, not their backyard.
O'Shaughnessy says the U.S. military will continue conducting large-scale joint exercises in the region and is analyzing whether to increase resources for early warning and detection systems. One way the military might expand is an increased maritime presence by Navy or Coast Guard forces in northern waters. Speaking in front of a large naval destroyer docked at the port of Anchorage last week during the symposium, Alaskan Command Colonel Mark Schmidt says the branches want to learn more about how their vessels work in the Arctic.
Right now, we know that the environment is changing. And what that means to us, we don't know. We want to understand and get after what capabilities and requirements are needed in this changing environment.
Alaskan Command's Arctic Maritime Symposium wrapped up last week on Thursday. Code for Anchorage is a group of tech-savvy, civic-minded volunteers who write software to help Alaskans access data and often link them to government services. One example is a free opt-in service that notifies users via text message each time election returns are updated. Another is CourtBot, which, with help from the Alaska Court System IT Department, sends text reminders for court dates. The group's captain is Brendan Babb, whose day job is Chief Innovation Officer for the Municipality of Anchorage. I caught up with him at a downtown Anchorage coffee shop to talk about Code for Anchorage.
Code for Anchorage, it's a part of Code for America. They're a nonprofit out of California, and they have different brigades, which is kind of inspired by like firemen's brigades, but basically local volunteers that work on trying to make government services work better. So we've done a lot of stuff like you can text in a bus stop number and it'll tell you when the bus is going to arrive, and just did something CourtBot, which will, you can text in a citation number and it'll remind you the evening before for your court hearing. So we've done a lot of text-based stuff.
It sort of makes me feel like this is the sort of thing that now is the type of infrastructure of the time that we're living in. Is that Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, I think so, in terms of working with government to see what information and data they have and trying to make services that people would use go where people are, like, because it's going to be easier to get people to look there. Election one came out of a hackathon we were working on and sending results out. And yeah, people have kind of latched on, and it basically just watches a web page each minute to see if it's been updated, and then sends out a text to let people know when it's been updated. Because we noticed at Election Central, people were just constantly refreshing their phones. So we're like, oh, maybe we could take that part out of it.
Tell me about the hackathon part of that. How does that work? Is that like you throw out a challenge and people try to come up with something, or how does it work?
We've had a couple hackathons in the past, and they've kind of been open-ended, but some people will present problems, and people will work on those, or people will bring their own ideas, and someone brought an idea of, like, is there a way to send updates for elections, and then over a weekend, people worked on that problem and came up with something that kind of worked by the end of the weekend, and then Code for Anchorage, we meet every 2 weeks.
Tell me more about the CourtBot, is that what it's called?
Yeah, CourtBot is something we just launched about a week ago for National Day of Civic Hacking. If you have a citation number for, let's say you have a speeding ticket that you didn't pay, you could text it in and it would tell you when your court date was, and you could opt in to get a reminder the day before. And it also works for criminal cases as well. So if you had multiple hearings, it could send you reminders the evening before for that. The goal is to reduce failures to appear, which can mean if you miss an appointment, it might change into a warrant for your arrest, or things might be escalated just because you weren't able to remember an appointment. I mean, when I get my haircut, I get a reminder a couple days before and just have to text C back. So it's nice to have the court system be as friendly as that.
What other stuff are you guys working on, or problems that you've thrown out that you're thinking about trying to create similar services for?
We're still kind of in the early works of looking at other projects, but we're trying to figure out how to know if a bike rack was full on a bus, and trying to think of creative ways to solve that. We have a WIC and SNAP pre-screener where you can text a child into a number or food, and then it'll give you the list of questions, like 8 or 9 questions, and help you see if you would likely qualify or not. And then if you would, then maybe take the next step to apply there.
You know, it strikes me as the kind of thing that if you're a coder, it makes sense, you know, how you would contribute to something like this. But are folks that are sort of not into coding, are they also involved?
Yeah, there's things that we want to test. We want to figure out how to market stuff. Everyone has great ideas on how to solve things. So it's open to other people, and everyone has talents that we can use.
Brendan Babb is the brigade captain for Code for Anchorage. To get alerts for updates as primary election results roll out tonight, text VOTE, that's V-O-T-E, to 907-312-1012. For more about Code for Anchorage's other projects, you can visit codeforanchorage.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues, and invite public participation at meetings on Wednesday, August 22nd and Thursday, August 23rd, starting at 9 a.m. at the Inupiat Heritage Center in Utqiagvik. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Descendants of Alaska's westernmost island want permanent access to their ancestral home. Since World War II, the native people of Attu have been separated from their homeland, first by the Japanese military, then by the American government. KUCB's Zoe Sobel has more on their new efforts to reconnect.
Outside forces have seized control of Attu Island many times, disrupting and even driving out its people. In the 1700s, it was the Russians who colonized the community during the fur trade. 200 years later, the Japanese military arrived and took the Attuans as prisoners of war to Japan, where half of them died in captivity. After that, it was the U.S. government that sealed off the island and forbade survivors from returning home. That finally changed last summer when 11 descendants received special permission to visit for the first time. But there were many, like Helena Smits, who couldn't make the journey.
But I feel like if I were able to go, it would definitely help my soul.
Now Smits is asking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to offer regular trips back to Attu, the homeland of her grandmother, Angeline Hodiakov. She first made her request this spring at the 75th commemoration of the Battle of Attu.
I want my children's children, to be able to go back to Attu with no cost to us. And that's the justice that needs to be done on our people. The U.S. government, the Japanese government, and the Russian government took our culture away, and we need your help since you guys own the island.
Fish and Wildlife oversees the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which cares for most of the island, although the Attu Village site is still owned by the Aleut Corporation. Top officials say Fish and Wildlife is open to the idea of descendants returning. They hosted a conference call in late July to get the discussion going. Teresa Deal joined Smits in representing the Attu descendants.
I'm going to say it again, it should not be a once-in-a-lifetime trip. Would I want to go back again? Yes, of course, I would be thrilled to be able to go back again.
Deal was part of the group that visited Attu last summer. Her mother, Marina Hodiakov, was born on the island, but Deal grew up disconnected from her culture in the Pacific Northwest. After making the meaningful trip, Deal says she wants the same opportunity for her children.
I would have liked to have had my sons there because then we can all help process the emotions and how neat it is to be up there.
Deal would also like the trips to be open to spouses and significant others. They may not be Native themselves, but she says they're part of the descendants' lives and provide an important support network as they deal with the trauma of displacement. Refuge Director Steve Delahanty says he's ready to listen to these requests. He's not a Tuan himself, but he understands where they're coming from.
We humans have these place connections that mean a lot. So I think it is totally understandable that it's coming from them. And I also think it's quite understandable that they're reaching out to the Fish and Wildlife Service to say, do you have any ideas for helping make this happen? Because we were able to do so in a small way last year.
While descendants made that trip aboard the research vessel Tekla, Delahanty says there's also an airstrip on Attu, so it's possible to fly. Still, at this point, he says descendants need to get more specific.
Is it only the physical ability to walk on the island? Is it being at the village site itself? Is it just more of a cultural connection where I don't know what.
Delahanty says involving more people may lead to creative solutions and funding. He's reaching out to other federal entities that have a stake and inviting them to join the conversation.
We have to kind of put on the table what the wish is, what the vision is, and then what the possibility is, and see if there's any overlap.
For their part, Deal and Smits are looking into funding from private entities and the possibility of creating a trust for the program. There's no set date for when anything will happen, but the group is planning to continue the conversation this fall. In On Alaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Some parts of the forest in southeast Alaska are a little off color. Hemlock trees are turning brown and yellow from a sawfly outbreak. But as KFSK's Angela Denning reports from Petersburg, scientists say there's not much to worry about.
The U.S. Forest Service started getting a lot of calls about yellowish trees on hillsides in southeast Alaska this month. The color is from dying hemlock leaves, which were damaged by an insect. So they got their experts to look into it.
This year has just been extraordinary to see the amount of activity.
Elizabeth Graham is an entomologist who works with the Forest Service in Juneau in a division called Forest Health Protection. And she's really into bugs.
They are just so cool, the things that insects can do.
The sawfly's larvae, which looks like tiny green caterpillars, are feasting on hemlock leaves as part of their short life cycle. They gorge on leaves just before creating their cocoons. As they eat, the leaves turn yellow and fall off.
When they're feeding in this great abundance like this, it's almost like you're standing in the woods and it can sound like it's raining, but it's not actually raining. Larvae are feeding and going to the bathroom.
The feeding frenzy damages the trees, but it doesn't kill them. The sawflies only eat old needles, leaving the new growth alone. Graham and other scientists have flown aerial surveys and taken samples on several islands, Mitkoff, Kuprinoff, Prince of Wales, and Admiralty. They did see a sawfly infestation, but they're not that concerned. The main reason is because sawflies are native to the region, so they're part of the normal ecosystem. And that means there are other species that keep the sawfly populations in check. One is fungi, which infect the larvae. But this summer's hot, dry weather hasn't been a good year for them, so sawflies have flourished. Another natural sawfly control comes later in the cycle, and that's the parasitoid wasps.
Which are really, really cool. They actually lay their eggs inside these pupal cases. And so the parasitoid wasp is feeding on the pupae inside the case, and then they will eventually burst out of the case and sort of like an alien.
And Graham is hoping that some of those alien wasps will emerge from the sawfly cocoons soon. She's collected several of the cases to take back to her lab to observe. There is another insect that can pair up with the sawfly to cause problems. That's the western black-headed budworm. They feed on the tree's new growth. So if they're having an outbreak at the same time as the sawfly, that can actually kill the trees. But scientists haven't seen that this year. It would take a few years in a row of the sawfly's population to go unchecked for there to be a cause for concern. And the bugs do play an important role in the forest.
Birds eat them, rodents, you know, small mammals. And so it's an abundant food source. It's not something we would want to eradicate.
This fall, the sawfly pupae will emerge from their brown cases as tiny wasps, but not the kind that sting. They'll mate up and then lay eggs, which overwinter and hatch in the springtime. Graham and her colleagues will continue to monitor them to make sure they're damaging trees, but in their normal, good-for-the-forest way. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Aaron McKinstry, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings. Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.